Ever questions for this evening? Okay, dear Ajahn, it's a nice question to start off with. Can you explain how memories travel with us into every rebirth? Thanks. The thing is that they don't travel with you at all. They don't travel anywhere. Just cause and effect, they just can be accessed from the past. So it's interesting that when we talk about memories, they're not stored anywhere. It's not as if that at every moment they're somehow in the brain or in some mind field or something like that, whereas they can always be accessed. The way the memories are accessed is something akin to what I call resonance. When you have an experience now, which is similar to an experience a long time ago, that sort of resonance, the sort of what sometimes people call jogging the memories, means that one can access sort of a long time ago. It's not as if that there's a string between the past moment and the present moment. It's just an access. Sometimes you call it science action at a distance. That's how we especially access past life memories. There's no way they could be stored anywhere in this body of ours. Perhaps they might be of another time, another place, even another eon. The only way that they can be accessed is that this moment resonates with a moment long past, and those two moments, separated by great lengths of time, connect, and thereby we have the memory of the past. Sometimes the people, because they only know time is linear, they think it's just a stream of time. That's why that sometimes they can't really understand how moments separated by long distances can connect through this resonance process. And that's where we have the really big memories. The memories which are just like re-experience in the past. Those are the sorts of memories one gets with past life memories. Or with some of you have got with early life memories. Where you're reliving the experience once more. You can smell the smells, you can see the scenery. You can even like move around in those places and see what it's like to be in your baby's pram again. What your first school was like. What your mother was like so many years ago, just after she gave birth to you. All very clear, very precise. This is not that memory is stored anywhere. It's as if that moment in the past and this moment now are somehow being connected. So nothing goes with you from life to life except what you call this potential, this karma. The ability to access what you were in the past. And memory, the way that memory works and the way that karma works is very similar. The linking of past moments to present moments. Make sense? Go on, yeah. Yes, sir?
Come down to our leaves of consciousness. Otherwise, you remember everything all the time, but you don't. So, therefore, is it just that even in this life, sometimes you're resonating with something that happened in the past in this life, and that's why you remember it. But other things are lost in memory sometimes.
Correct, yes, you're just resonating with something in the past. And it's always available, as it were, to be resonated with. But again, you know what ordinary memory is. It's just the memory of a memory of a memory of a memory of a memory. The memory of the last time you remembered it. And as such, it's not really a true memory. It's just a memory of a memory. And that's what most people take to be memories. But when you get to like these memories which come up in meditation, it's just a reliving the experience. It's a different type of memory. And that's the one which is a real resonance. Interesting, I saw a documentary once about this fellow who lost his memory. He couldn't remember his wife. But some of these psychological traumas were very, very fascinating. He was a Londoner. And he just woke up and there was a woman. He didn't know who she was. And that was his wife. And they couldn't find out exactly what had happened. It just happened one afternoon. And they tried to find out exactly what's happened. And eventually they hypnotized the guy. Another hypnosis. He could remember everything. Remember marrying the lady and sort of causing her falling in love. What actually happened, he was working in the workshop in the back of his house. The phone rang, and he rushed to go and get the phone and hit his head on the window, knocked himself out. And he recalled it in his process, and they gave him the post-hypnotic suggestion, he would remember everything from the past. And when he came out of hypnosis, he still couldn't remember who his wife was. The hypnosis didn't work. It's fascinating, and hypnosis, the memories are there, they just can access them. Strange, isn't it? Then I can grab, what is volition? Is it mental defilements, bad mental factors? No, volition isn't always bad. Sometimes volition is good if it's moving towards nirvana. That's why they say that good karma and bad karma, it comes from good volition or bad volition. And the definition of good volition and bad volition, or good karma and bad karma, is that if it's a step towards nirvana, it's good karma. If it's a step in the opposite direction, more entanglement, it's called bad karma. And whether it's towards or against nirvana. And you can see that's why acts of selfishness just build up the self, acts of anger, again, just build up the self as well, and build up those defilements, acts of desire that's built up the controller, and that's why it is against nirvana. But good karma, such as generosity, you're giving up, you're letting go of desire. Compassion, forgiveness, gives up ill will. Meditation gives up controlling. Contentment gives up all this managing of life, restlessness. So these are all good karma acts, because they lead in the opposite direction. Keeping precepts is good karma. It leads to nirvana, you're giving up bad volitions. So this volition, that's what it is, it's the movement of the mind. And it's either good karma or bad karma, depending on whether it leads to nirvana or in the opposite direction. Does that make sense? Next question. Ajahn, you say we shouldn't fear death, yet most people go down, not up. To get another human birth is less chance than a blind turtle in the ocean. So surely we have a lot to fear. Indeed, this is the last night of the retreat. Who knows when you'll be able to get another retreat again. Even if you live for the next retreat next year, you might not make it in the queue. Who knows? So, it's all that fear. And most people go down, not up, but most people don't go on retreats. So, you know, if all the people in the world, you're like the cream of the crop, and the cream always floats to the surface. It's true. So that, you know, you guys and girls, you shouldn't be able to fear death. If you've been on a retreat like this, it'd be just so wonderful just to die. It's an opportunity to let go, especially if you die just after the retreat. All that's true. All that good karma, all that good dharma is just right there in front of you, you haven't forgot it. So it's wonderful, if you die just after a retreat, oh, you're just really doing well. I mean that, because sometimes it's like a week, 2 weeks, 6 months later, you forget all this stuff. And all that peace, all that wisdom, tends to get submerged in the busyness of life. But now would be a wonderful time today. So free, so peaceful, the dharma fresh in your heart. That's why they say people who die when they go on pilgrimage to the holy places in India, they always go to heaven. They get a good rebirth. The reason is because the inspiration is right there with them. So, most people go down, not up. A lot of people bounce up and down, and you're one of those people who bounce up and down. You're keeping precepts. How many people do you know in the world keep precepts? How many people in the world do you know keep 8 precepts for 9 days? So you're the type of people who float. So you don't need to fear death at all if you've done lots of good karma. Now to get another human birth is less chance than a blind turtle in the ocean. I remember reading that sutta, but really I think if you've been a human birth yourself and you've lived this life and you've lived a good life, then the chance of getting a human birth again is quite strong. They say that in the, what's it called, Sapurisa Sutta. No, not, yes, Sapurisa Sutta. That's right, yes, it is a Purusa Sutta. No, not that. It's what's it called? The Sankara Upapati. Yes, Sankara Upapati Sutta. Where a person, if they've kept precepts, and there being enough good merit, just ordinary good merit, if you aspire to any of these realms, I aspire to being a human again, then you get that aspiration. Or if you aspire to being a deva, you get that aspiration. Sankara Upapati Sutta, the arising according to your aspirations. In that particular case, the aspirations, the will, is part of Sankara. So, if you actually have good merit and you aspire to be a human being again, then you get that. So I think where it says in this particular simile, which is very, very common because it makes people very afraid, I really think that it means that if you are outside of the human realm, then it's very hard to get sort of an entry into the realm. Once you fall out, it's very hard to get back again. It's the same as like you're in some sort of like company, some business. Once you're in that business, it's maybe easy to get promotions, get sort of put into another place in that business. The harder thing is just getting the foothold in the door, getting in first of all. So once you've got a human birth, it's much easier to continue with another human birth afterwards. But if you've fallen out of the human realm, it's very hard to get an entry. I think that's what it really means. So now you have a human birth, make the best use of it. If you make the best use of it, you'll be able to get a human birth again until the time you become fully enlightened. Certainly if you're a stream winner, then you'll go up to a deva realm and then afterwards come back to this human realm again until you become a fully enlightened person. So if you become a stream winner, you've got nothing to fear at all. It's heaven realms and human realms all the way to the end. But even if you're not a stream winner, if you are still someone who has lots of faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, Sangha, you do lots of generous acts, you are moral, keep virtuous precepts, you listen to the Dhamma, discuss the Dhamma, practice meditation, practice compassion, you've got nothing to fear. Yeah?
Most of the people come to the much later in life, and obviously we've got a past, so if you're still thinking in the past, wouldn't that count?
Well, you go in the past, yeah. What happens is that the past is sometimes that if you're very inspired and you have like a lot of goodness, a lot of morality, that particular lifestyle can't really resonate with the past. And so it's a sense that you're blocking the past out by your lifestyle of the present. So it's great if you keep morality, because you're just thinking moral things. You're thinking goodness, you're being goodness, you're living with other good people. Even though there might be some lingering karma from the past, which is sort of bad, sometimes it needs the opportunity to resonate. Just like memories, you need something similar to jog your memory of something of the past. You need some sort of similar occasion for past karma to actually manifest. So if you live a very, very, very good life, always like doing good things, being kind, being generous, forgiving, compassionate, sometimes it's almost like blocking out the past bad karma. Just can't quite get in there. So that if it's blatant in your life, make sure that you, the rest of your life, you're a very, very pure-hearted, good person. Always keep very good speech, kind speech, never harsh speech to any other person. So your ill will just subsides. People do bad things to you. Well, I keep telling people, never allow other people to control your happiness. They say stupid things and bad things to you, never get upset. If you only give people a chance to make you upset and angry back, don't do that. Don't allow others to control your happiness and well-being. They can call you what they want, but I'm not going to be unhappy as a result. My happiness is my concern. I don't allow anybody to control my happiness. I'm the owner of my karma. No one else. This question. Are the four Iddhipadas for individual types of samadhi, or is the samadhi relating to the Iddhipadas a cumulative result of all four factors? I really think it's the cumulative result of all four factors, because I think it was one of the suttas. I think it was Ananda gave a simile of the Iddhipadas, and he said this in the Jetavana to a man who just come to ask him the question. He said, look, the reason you've come here to the monastery is because of four Iddhipadas. You aspired to come here, and you wanted to come to the Jacob Grove Monastery. You put forth the energy to come here, you apply the mind, you continue coming here, and you investigate to find out the best way to come here. So that's the four Vidyapadas. A nice little metaphor. Aspiration to get there, putting forth the energy in the right places, and your feet, instead of thinking, how am I going to get there? What's the best way to the Jhana Grove? Maybe I should read a book about how to get to the Jhana Grove. Maybe I should ask all the wise men in town where the Jhana Grove is. Maybe I should go to the coffee shop and start talking about discussing the way to get to the Jhana Grove. Maybe I should do it tomorrow when I've got more time. All these other ways of thinking, we don't really put energy in the right places. So that person said, I'll go walk now. To put forth energy now, as well as aspiration, always applied his mind while he was walking so he didn't forget what he was doing. You know, sometimes you may go to the shops, you forget what you went there for. You're not applying your mind. And lastly, investigate to make sure that you always found the best way to get to the Jhana Grove. You didn't sort of go through the puddles or fall over the rocks. There's always alert at the time. So it's wisdom, investigation, four Vidyapada, applying the mind. The third, or the second is energy. The first is aspiration, the inclination. And that's where you got to Jhana Grove. So that's a beautiful simile of the Ananda. It's bringing the Vidyapadas down to real life. So they're a cumulative result of all the four factors. Samadhi. So it's cumulative. All things go together. So really, I don't see how you can have one of those Vidyapadas without the others. Otherwise, it's a new work. Make sense? Next question. I have the good fortune of having a free, around-the-world, non-transferable aeroplane ticket. That's interesting. I wonder where this question is going to lead. There are certain spiritual places I feel drawn to in Central and South America, as well as in India. Is there any value in doing this sort of thing? You ever notice, if you get an around the world ticket, you always end up where you started. So how many of us had around samsara tickets? So long. So the spiritual places you feel drawn to in Central and South America, the best place is in Central you. In Central present moment, in Central silence, in Central breath, in Central nimitta, in Central jhana. Those are the best places to go to. Around the world ticket. Sometimes actually you wonder why people travel so much. I must admit though, if you're going to go anywhere, go to the holy places in India. I must admit, they are worth going to. Just because they give you heaps and heaps of inspiration. I've already mentioned that there are sometimes there are power places in this world. I said this in the interview though, maybe I said it here. There's some places where you can sit down and you get peaceful so quickly. It's so easy to meditate. And, you know, I know those places, and some places I sit down and it's just so easy, just so much power. Some of those places are in India, in the holy places. Sometimes you just go and sit in these places and wow, the energy which comes through you. Beautiful, it's blissful, it's just no problem at all. I think other people, even if they're just mediocre meditators, would have great meditation. Yeah, as I said, I think in the interviews, there's some places you go and sit where the Buddha actually sat. In the caves, in the Vulture's Peak, in the Jhana Grove Monastery, you can actually plant your bottom down in the very place where the bottom of the Buddha once rested. It's that meditation that just blows you away. The power is still there. It is. You go to those places and everyone feels it. So those are real places you want to go and get yourself really inspired. If you can't get sort of good meditation anywhere else, you will get it there. But give yourself time, and sometimes in those, some of the trips to India, people go to these places, take their photographs, do some chanting, and then go to the next place. It's true, it's such a shame. So it's nice for you to go on good tours where you can actually go to these places for 1 or 2 days. So that where there's like, you know, leading monks or sort of meditators. So they can actually take these places, like everyone sit down and meditate. No chanting, no, put the cameras away. And just sit there for a while and allow the energies to really sort of get into you. and give you lots of time. You can hang out in those places. That's when it really gets good. So that's what I would do. I would sort of take the flight all the way to India, and then all the way to India, all the way around and back again. That's enough. Yeah. Sri Lanka, that's got a lot of powerful places as well. Because I've been to those places, and some of the... You've got to get out of the way. And it's, if you go to the ordinary places everybody goes to, then it's not really powerful. There's some like hermitages, there's some like forest monasteries which are just so old. I had the privilege of going there, and just outside of Mahindalay, that's where the Arahat Mahinda landed, from India, the first monk who came to Sri Lanka. And just, you know, after, you know, looking up there and going around the Chedu and stuff like that, just, you know, only about a couple of kilometres away, this lovely cave monastery. And it just had a real atmosphere that was abandoned. No one was there, but it was so powerful. And then just next to that was another monastery, a kilometre where I stayed the night in this old cave, which had been built into a nice little kuti. And it had on the inscription there on the original donor, which was something like 1700 years ago. That's really great, sort of sitting in a cave hut where monks have been meditating and sleeping there for over 1700, 1800 years. Wow, that was really good. Got good meditation there. Because I'm sure that some of those would be arahats, meditating in those caves. So that's, yeah, there's a few places like that you really get off on. So if you have to actually go with someone who knows their way around, it doesn't just go and take you to the ordinary places, but the other way places. The same with in Burma, or even Thailand. If you just go just with a tour, and there's no sort of like monks around, who sort of know their way around, know where all the great monks are and all the great places are, you waste so much time. So if you go on one of these monk tours, so they're really good. Because you know, the last time when a few of you went over to Thailand to see Ajahn Yanas and Ajahn Priya. It's amazing you got to do that. Because no way, other people could actually go and see Ajahn Priya and like that and all these other great monks. So, you know, Ajahn Yana just opened up lots and lots of doors there. And that's great, you could actually do things like that. So those are really good tours to go on if you're going to do anything. Those people who went on that tour said they really got a lot out of it. Sometimes you go and see sort of like a forest edition to find out what it's all about. Unfortunately, it has changed. They don't give you frogs to eat anymore, which is a great shame. Really, really good to see what I have to eat with those old birds. These soft these days. Dear Ajahn, thank you for the loving kindness surf and meditation suggestion. I had a beautiful letting go in the garden this afternoon. Even Jesus holding the lamb on the tapestry in the hall looks so much happier now. Well done. Thank you. That's welcome meditation suggestion. That was just to let you know what that is. But sometimes you've got some negativity, things you don't like, or people you don't like, or experiences you don't like. You can actually imagine after you settle down in meditation a circle. And inside that circle is all the things which you like and approve of. All the meditations during this retreat which have been good ones, which you've got a tick. And outside, on the edge of that circle, is all the things which are not really sort of things you dislike, but you don't really like them either. They're just sort of neutral, just on the edge of the circle. And as you go further from the circle, you go to the things which you dislike. And some of the people, the food, some of the meditation, some of the teaching, some things about yourself, about the place you dislike. And as you go further out from the circle, it gets even worse. People, situations, places you just really dislike, and parts of yourself you dislike. If you go further, it gets worse. And as you set that circle up inside your mind with what you really like in the centre, what's on the edge of the circle neutral, what's outside the circle further away, the worse it gets, then you imagine that circle expanding. Imagine what it's like just to expand that circle. So the things you're neutral to now are included inside of you, inside your circle of approval. You actually see that you can like those things. What happens when you start expanding your circle even a little bit? It feels good. You get an instant reward of pleasure, joy, inspiration. And that encourages you to expand the circle just a tiny bit more. And that gives you even more happiness and freedom and peace. and expand it even more. Before you know it, you're bringing into your circle experiences and people, situations which before you just didn't like. But now actually they're inside. They're approved of, they're liked even. And that just encourages you even more until that circle gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And actually, surprisingly, includes all your enemies as well, and things you just really dislike, and just which you didn't like about yourself, bad meditations, terrible talks, whatever else happened, it all gets included in. And then you don't stop there, because it gets so much fun expanding your circle to embrace everything. Just the edge of that circle just goes off into the infinite spaces of the universe. It goes so far away you can't see it anymore. You've included the whole universe in your circle. And that really feels good. You've given loving kindness to the whole universe, the whole world. Everything is included in, nothing is rejected. No person, no event, no meditation, no situation, nothing. You've expanded the circle to include the whole universe. All time, past and future, and the present moment, all inside your circle. And then you just stay there for a little while, and then when you come out of meditation, you find you're back to where you started again. The circle, things you like and things you don't like, but it's slightly bigger this time. And you do that enough times in that circle, you know, stretching it again and again, gets so supple that it actually does start to stretch and include many more things than you ever thought you could imagine. So it's just a little mental exercise of actually stretching the area, the things, situations which meet your approval. That's a little circle meditation. Make sense? Okay. So, okay, next question. Ajahn Brahm, you've spoken about the first, second, third and fourth jhanas. Do these jhanas coincide with the different stages of enlightenment? Is a person fully enlightened after reaching the fourth jhana? Can you please elaborate on the fifth to the ninth jhanas? Thank you. Okay, fortunately I can put this question aside because coming out soon in paperback is the next issue of the journal. And all your questions on jhanas will be answered in that one. And even the immaterial jhanas, they're in that one as well. So that's the next issue of our Buddhist Society's journal. The four jhanas, they don't coincide with stages of enlightenment. It's just the first jhana, I say, is the minimum requirement to get stream winning. If you get second and third and the fourth, the mind is even more powerful, even more data, it makes it even harder to miss what's actually going on. So the deeper the jhanas, the more often, the more powerful, the more likely it is you get stages of enlightenment. And the more often you get those jhanas, the higher the stages of enlightenment. This actually is said absolutely clearly, that there's no way of getting to be an anagami without developing those jhanas. In fact, that's usually what the stream winner does. That's their path to becoming a non-returner, having experienced a jhana or two and had enough data to get the first stage of enlightenment. Then they do lots and lots of jhanas, because getting those lots and lots of jhanas, the message comes through that the body and the five senses are no real place where you can find happiness, but the mind seems to be the place where you find happiness. So they let go of the body and they look for their happiness in the realm of the mind, in the jhana realms. And thereby they become anagamis, non-returners. They cut off karma chanda, the desire for the body and for the five senses, and with it ill will. And what they're left with is just the attachment to the jhana realms. That's just the anagami. So that's actually just the usual path you see in the suttas for the anagami. They say the stream winner has perfected sila. The anagami has perfected samadhi, the jhanas. And the arahat has perfected wisdom. Now the fifth and ninth jhanas, you'll see them in the book coming out soon in a Buddhist society near you. Any questions on that? Comments? Okay. Ajahn, what Buddha had advice to Bahya Bhadwana. Is it the practice we should do when we don't sit for meditation? I think he was talking about Bahya, I think. Yes, right. Bahya, I think Bahya Deva, he was. It's Bahya. What's it, David? It's for the loincloth, yeah. Or no cloth at first. Because what happened was Bahya, he was. You have to go back to his previous life. There was a group of, I think, 5 monks in the time of Kassapa the Buddha, which was a previous Buddha to this Buddha, and they decided to enlighten or bust, literally. So they went up to this mountain, and they had to climb up this ladder to get up there. But they got up to the summit, and they threw the ladder down. So no more alms food, no more eating. They're going to sort of meditate, they're going to get jhanas, enlightenment up there, or they're going to starve to death. And I think one of them became an arahat, if I remember the story correctly. One of them became an anagami, and I think Bahya was one of the ones who didn't get anything, just died up there. And in this life, he got reborn in the west of India, this last life, and he was a sailor. He could have been a merchant. Was he a merchant or a sailor? But anyway, he got shipwrecked. And he managed to swim to the shore, and by the time he got to the shore, he was completely naked. He lost all his clothes. I know what it's like in India. If anyone of you ever been to India, when people do strange things like go naked, they're considered to be holy. And so when this guy turned up in the village without any clothes on, they thought he was holy. So they started giving him food, and like feeding him and worshipping him. And he thought, this is much better than working on sailing. You know, you get all your food for free, all you have to do is just go make it. So he really got into this being like a holy man and being better all the time. And so sort of he actually thought he was actually something, he really thought he was enlightened. Simply because of how much respect he was given and how much food he was given. And thinking that just going naked and keeping those disciplines was enough to be enlightened. But then his old friend from the previous life, was the anagami, came down and told him, you aren't an arahat, nor are you even close to being an arahat. And that really shocked this Bahya. Obviously that he could see or hear this anagami, and actually what happened next showed that he did have special abilities as a sailor. And obviously this was from his jhanas from the previous life, because the deva told him that there is a samana, a monk called the Buddha on the other side of India. You should go to him and ask for some teachings. And Bahya actually went that night, and he actually travelled halfway across India from the west coast to the Ganges valleys in one evening. Obviously through some sort of psychic power, so he had something there. And he managed to find the Buddha as he was going on arms round. And asked the Buddha a question. The Buddha said, this is a long time, Bahya, I'm on arms round now, wait till afterwards. But twice he asked. Twice the Buddha refused, the third time he asked. The Buddha actually said, I'll give you a small teaching. And the teaching was, in the seen, let there only be the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the smelled, in the tasted. In the felt by the body, only the felt. And in the known, let there only be the known. That's my teaching to you. And Bahya was so smart, that was enough for him to become enlightened. And then afterwards, he said he wanted to become a monk, so he went off to search for Bolan Robe, and on the way got killed by a cow. That was the end of Bahya. That was his Parinibbana. And the Buddha said he was the person the quickest to understand the Dhamma. Now, I said that, I think, pretty accurately, to what the Buddha said. In the seen, let there only be the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the cognized by the smell, taste, or touch, only that. And in the known, let there only be the known. Are you enlightened? Why not? It's the same teaching. The reason is because the supporting conditions were there for Bahya, but not for us. The reason was because if you realize his past life, just so committed to renunciation, not only a monk, but just deciding to forget food, forget all of these comforts of a monastery, forget all this, you know, go to houses, blessings, chanting, doing all this sort of stuff. Let's go up into a mountain, forget about even our bodies and death. We're going to meditate, throw the ladder down, it's either real, jhanas, or bust. So he busted, but so much commitment there. He obviously got something up there on that mountain. When he got reborn, he had all these supporting conditions. Could hear devas and could travel across India in one night. So he's obviously a very, very powerful being. That's why he could understand the teaching. That's Bahia of the bark crop. I think actually it wasn't. Did he actually wear bark crop or was it actually naked? I think it was the bark crop of it. Yeah. Okay, that's Bahia. Sometimes people misunderstand that and they think, oh, all you need to do, you don't need to do meditation, you don't need to keep precepts, you don't need to actually understand the Dhamma, you don't even need to go to meditation retreats. All you need to do is just to hear that teaching, that's all you need. And so I hear that people say this proves you don't need to meditate to become enlightened. You just need to read and to be a philosopher and to be smart, that's all you need. But it's only, as I was saying the other day, that it's like somebody just sees the graduation ceremony in some big university hall and they think that's all you need to get a degree. They don't see all the preparation, all the work which went in before that ceremony could actually happen. All the work which went into Bahia's practice before he heard those teachings. So those teachings were just, as they say, the straw which broke the camel's back. The last little piece of the jigsaw, just enough for Bahia to become fully enlightened. Ajahn, a stream winner is guaranteed to become arahat. Can someone on the path to become a stream winner not become a stream winner? That's the thing is, they have to become a stream winner, as I was saying the other day. So if you're on the path of being a stream winner, it's already too late. No turning back now. That's it, I'm afraid. You're done for. Samsara is fatally injured. So, as I said the other day, that someone who's on the path of being a stream winner has to reach the fruit of stream winning in this very life. They have to, there's no other alternative. Which means that once you actually taste some of this Dhamma, it's amazing because you can't give it up. You can't stop. You've seen something and you've got some faith in these teachings, even though they seem to be even fearful at times, non-self, all this sort of business. Ah! No will, I'm not doing this. Ah, please give me something to rely on. Give them something inspiring. Like, you know, sort of a god of agape forever and ever. Compassionate, like a cosmic consciousness. Or some great sort of ground of all being where you sink into and unite one with the whole universe forever and ever and ever. It's much more interesting being one with the universe than being none with the universe. But, I'm not here to please you. So the problem is, once you hear these teachings, there's something about them, you know they're right. You don't want them to be right, but you know they are. And so, basically you've got no choice now. Eventually you just have to go for it. And you know that sort of the peace lies in giving up, in letting go of renunciation. Even though you sort of try to forget that, even deny it, you know it. So it has to happen. You have to actually go for it. It's only a matter of time. So most of you are done for. Dear Ajahn, did the Buddha ever answer the big why questions? Ajahn Chah did. You know that story. And Ajahn, the answer to the question why? Story? Yeah. Hands up if you haven't heard that. There's quite a few of you. Amazing. I tell the story so often. This was personal. Because Ajahn Chah is always a great teacher, and sometimes what you read in the books of Ajahn Chah is just all the little pearls which have been distilled from the dross because he would talk for hour upon hour upon hour, and most of it was just so boring and repetitive and silly stuff. But every now and again he'd say something really inspiring, and that's what is being taken out of everything else and put in these books. So sometimes we think that Ajahn Chah is just a really inspiring teacher, you know, that every talk was like this and all the monks were just hanging on every word. Most of the time you hope he was stopping soon. I must admit. But every now and again he says something which was really worth it after all that time. That's true, that's what it was like. But he'd always say something which was really to the point, and that was really made it worthwhile. And every now and again, but sometimes, not in his talks, but in his, like, you know, one-liners, just though he's talking to people or talking to you, that's where you get the really great teachings of Ajahn Chah. And so a lot of those other teachings you see in those books are actually not in formal talks, but in situations of how he responded. Now, towards Ajahn Chah's later years, when he was still teaching, he started to become sick. He always used to say that, you know, he'd get tired, and he said his head would spin sometimes. Something was going wrong. So, as Westerners, we were very sharp in this. We decided to build a sauna at Wat Nanachat, which was about 6 kilometres from Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. So he set up this international monastery, so the Westerners, he was such a wise person. He wasn't just a teacher. He knew that one day those Westerners would go back to Western countries and set up monasteries. So he decided to teach us not just how to become monks, but teach us how to run monasteries. So it was a piece of land close by, lay people want to start a monastery. Okay, you Westerners, you go over there, and you try it out. You try being an abbot, a vice abbot, you know, just other monks helping out. And when it was all messed up, Ajahn Chah was just down the road, so he could sort it all out. So he was actually giving you the training for the abbots. And no other sort of teacher did that. They'd maybe trained monks, but never trained abbots. That's why there's so many abbots and so many monasteries of that tradition around now. Brilliant. So that we built a sauna for him at this monastery. And I was there at the time. I helped on that sauna. And the reason we did this was some compassion for Ajahn Chah so he could get healthy, but the main reason was to get him to the monastery once a week. Because we know Ajahn Chah, he'd come there for his sauna, but he'd also come and talk to you and give a Dhamma discourse. So by building this sauna, we managed to get our great teacher, Ajahn Chah, into our monastery once a week without fail. And those sort of the sisters were saying they sort of wanted to see more of the monks. And so imagine if you sort of, I got very ill and you built like a sauna there. Sort of decided to come and visit once a week. Or knowing me, you're probably best to build a fish and chip shop there. That's only a joke. Don't do it. Sometimes I say these things and people take me up on them. My goodness. But anyway, we built a sauna so Ajahn Chah would come once a week. And he'd always give nice discourses. Sometimes we're bored, but it would be something nice at the end. And then afterwards we go and take him to the sauna. We do like our duties for our teacher, you know, help him sort of in the sauna, maybe massage his back, wash his bathing cloth, you know, get his robes ready when he's finished to help him dress again. So that was our duties. We love doing that. It's that way of paying sort of gratitude to a father figure, look after them. And one day that Ajahn Chah gave a really good talk, and after the talk it just really inspired, I was inspired, and so there's lots of other monks around, so I let the other monks go and look after Ajahn Chah, and I just went to the back of the hall at Wat Nanachat and sat meditation, I don't know, half an hour, something like that, just, you know, one of these really nice meditations, you get very, very peaceful, very, very bliss, and it's so high. And so when I finished my meditation, I came out, no one was around, so obviously I thought I'd go and see if I can help Ajahn Chah. Maybe I can still do something for him. So I went walking from those had been Wat Nanachat. It's a new sauna. The old sauna used to be where I think the sewing rooms are now, over there. So I went down to see if I could find Ajahn Chah and maybe help him. I was obviously too late because he was coming along the path in the opposite direction with two Thai men. And I missed not being able to help him. But I still went up to, you know, up towards him. And you know, Ajahn Chah gave me one of these looks, like these great monks do, which go right through you. Your nose checking you out to see what you've been doing. Because he'd obviously seen I had a lovely smile on my face, which is what happens when you get a nice meditation, all glowing. He wanted to check me out. So he checked me out, and then he came up to me. And again, just like a teacher, like awesome, but not fearsome, because you know you had this great trust for this guy. And he said, Brahmavamsa, Tamai, which means in Thai, Brahmavamsa, why? He's being like a Zen master, why? He's asked me the question, why? And so, being sort of just come out of a nice meditation and being a monk for about 5 or 6 years, I said, I don't know. And that gets, I was always just laughed his head off. And then he looked at me again after finishing his laugh with one of these penetrating looks again. He said, I'll tell you the answer. Next time someone asks you that, the answer to the question why is. Ajahn Chah, it's a great arahat. The answer to the question why. Well, you always wanted to know in this retreat, now you have the answer to the question why. He said, my mirai. Which means, there's nothing. There's nothing. That's the answer to the question why. And then he asked me, he said, do you understand? And I said, yes. He said, no you don't. Good boy. But I always remember that. That's one of those lovely sort of encounters with your teacher. Answer to the question why. It's nothing. Do you understand? No, you don't. It's great, isn't it? Because those are the answers that actually stay with you. And the question stays with you. And you contemplate, you can't help contemplating it. The answer to the question why, there's nothing. Emptiness. Nothing there. No self. When you actually start to see that, you understand why it's just a beautiful answer. So, the Buddha, I don't know if he answered the question why, but certainly Ajahn Chah did. And now you have the answer. That's the answer to the question why. It's nothing. Isn't that a great answer? And it goes on here. Are the cosmic cycles ends to its means, or is there a process of growth somewhere that takes place in consciousness? 35 billion years of our existence going to dissolve into nothing to start again into chaos. What a perspective. To dissolve into chaos, it's chaos already. You forgot what it's like out there with those streets outside the retreat centre. What a perspective. Thank you for your ever-inspiring talks. The cosmic cycle, are the ends its means, or is there a process of growth somewhere? I suppose, you know, the cosmic cycles are just great teachers, whether it's the cycle of your life, the cycle of the retreats, the cycle of the cosmos, what begins, ends, just this process which keeps going on, and the cosmic cycles go on despite all of your intentions and wills and desires and cravings. You're not in charge. One of the nice things about the cosmos, you look in the cosmos, you look in the stars at night, you realise just how significant you are. How irrelevant you are. Isn't it nice to think we're really irrelevant now? My doer is completely irrelevant, the process goes on anyway, so you get out of the way and just sit in the back of the bus and enjoy the journey. Don't stop complaining about the cosmos. Because you answer the question why, there is no cosmos. There's nothing there. Next question. Dear Ajahn, if our chanting is going to be as out of tune at the big Wastex celebration as those who do it for free, nah, this is all about contentment. Because at the big Wastex celebration, we're going to do this chanting, and it's going to be mind blowing. I've never heard chanting like this before. Then Jeff Gallop and the other VIPs might run away with their hands over their ears. Why can't we Buddhists chant better than the Catholic Gospel Choir in the church next door? That's a good question. Is cutting because they get in on the Y before they do shakti. Yeah, it's a good question that. So I leave that till afterwards sometimes, so we have to do some shouting practice. But it doesn't really matter, because actually on the big day anyway, that things happen. And then the chanting gets very, very, very nice. Because over here, that, you know, we're doing lots of meditation, and just we're letting go, we're not really putting that sort of effort into it. There's so many other people doing it. So when you get heaps and heaps of people doing it, it really sounds good. How much of the book of the story of Ajahn Mun is hagiography and just made up? And actually that's a very good question, because when that book was first translated from Thai into English, it's just been published, and I had to go visit Ajahn Mahabua's monastery. And I was told straight away by Ajahn Panya, he's a senior Western monk with Ajahn Mahabua, he said, well, that is a really terrible translation, because the person has added what he thought Ajahn Mahabua wanted to talk about Ajahn Mun, but couldn't say because of monastic rules. So he said he added so much into that, which is not in the original Thai. However, it's a nice read. And you know, some of it is actually, it's true, but some of it isn't. Actually, there's other stuff about Ajahn Mun. There's one story which I have, which no one else knows. It's because when I used to go on wandering through Thailand, you go through some of these places, and these people who would look after you, you know, in the evening, they come and meditate with you, maybe do some chanting on top of the mountain, and they tell you their stories. They spend the evening telling old stories about old monks and what happened here, and some really interesting tales they would tell. And they told me about this monk called Ajahn Mun, who was in this area, in Khao Wong province, which is, where is that? That's south of Sokonakon, a bit north of Kalasin, around that area over there. And they were saying that in some of those caves in there, there's some gold. So Ajahn Mun with another monk had gone to one of these caves and started digging out gold from the cave. And when he got enough gold, he took it down to Wat Pho Wong in Bangkok to give to a Chao Khun, one of these senior monks, to make some gold with spectacles. And when I heard that, I said, that can't be, you know, the real Ajahn Mun, the great Arahant monk. Oh yeah, that was him. You know, the one who's got his museum in Sokonakon, which was just up the road. That's amazing, isn't it? That's a story they'll find in the book, because it's a bit sus. You know, sort of digging out gold and making gold, because monks aren't supposed to do that. There's all these other little stories which you sort of get to know, really interesting, which, you know, the monks tell you, but they don't tell other people. So there's always going to be some editing in these little books. And it's nice actually when you get sort of the monks telling all their stories and you get this fuller picture of Ajahn Mun. Because sometimes who was it? I think mostly Ajahn Mahabua wrote that biography of Ajahn Mun. And sometimes it made Ajahn Mun look very fierce. Because that's what Ajahn Mahabua was. He was fierce. So he saw Ajahn Mun through his own eyes. And some of the other monks would actually tell you that Ajahn Mun was just the most softest and kindest of monks you could ever imagine. He was so gentle, so peaceful, so nice. And he would never sort of, you know, hurt you at all or even say strong words to you. So it's interesting that different people have different perspectives. You know what? Ajahn Chah's funeral, when all the monks went there to do the funeral rites for Ajahn Chah. Of course, you know what we started talking about, what Ajahn Chah taught. And it's actually a fascinating experience, because we started talking about what Ajahn Chah taught, and Ajahn Chah taught this. He taught the person, no, he taught dharma. No, he taught letting go. No, he taught this. And the monks started arguing about what Ajahn Chah taught. And I think it was Ajahn Chah at the time. He sort of summed it up and said, you know, for every monk there's a different Ajahn Chah. We always remember those teachings of our teacher which really meant something for us, which we really sort of took to our heart, which meant something. And all the other stuff we just filter out, we forget. So it's true there is a different Ajahn Chah for every monk who's alive, who remembers it. And there will be a different Ajahn Mun. So what you read in the biography is Ajahn Mahabua's Ajahn Mun. So what would be anybody else's Ajahn Mun? It's fascinating. So hagiography, yeah. But also we always remember from our teacher or our teachers only those events which inspired us, which we made use of, which were important to us. Anything else we don't hear. That's why sometimes after a talk, sometimes you ask people, what did Ajahn Mun talk about this evening? Very good. Somebody else says something else. And sometimes you think it's a different talk, different teacher. Yeah, you got a question?
Is it true that in Thailand, the monks are not supposed to smile when preachers are taken?
That was in the old days. That's what I was told, that when you had your picture taken, you weren't allowed to smile. Because if you were smiling, you're just indulging. You're supposed to be suffering and be the tough forest monk. So it was like a macho thing. And it was just like the fashion that, you know, the monks would actually just be tough. And even Ajahn Mun, that had two pictures of him, that was all there was, and they were all just very fierce. And then what was it, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago? A person died in Ubon, that's, you know, quite close right here in Charles Monastery. And the children were rummaging through their possessions. They found another photo of Ajahn Mun, and the number 3. And that was when he was just not really smiling, but his face was just so clear and soft and peaceful. And that was another aspect of Ajahn Mun. But it was only when they were actually based at the Westerners that actually started coming to Thailand, and Ajahn Chah realized that, you know, the way to inspire Westerners is actually to smile. So he'd always smile in private. Same with Ajahn Mahabua, this fierce monk. And if they people around, he'd shout at you. And, well, not these days, he's changed as well, he smiles now. But even in those days, when it came down to tea time, you know, when all the monks were together, and just no lay people, and they'd really relax, then he'd tell jokes, and just laugh, and smile. That was not the time to be fierce. And it was amazing actually to see the monks actually at tea time together. Just like, you know, sometimes it's like a bunch of kids playing around and cracking jokes. And you can't see our tea time at Bodhidharma Monastery. Remember when I was a lay person, used to have this program on television called Zoo Time, and you used to have the monkeys tea party. It used to be very funny. So we've got the monkeys tea party, it's also very funny. So this is when you relax and just enjoy each other's company. So it's only later on that the monks actually learned how to smile, because it became a fashion to smile. So the later photographs, you see all the monks smiling. And if they're really upset, you're supposed to smile. Because otherwise, people don't think you're holy anymore. It's really strange. All those years that people restrain and learn how to be, look fierce, and now sort of holiness is like smiling holiness. What should I say to the people I work with who are a little interested in meditation? Especially the Catholic lady who knows at this centre, who's been taught that it's best not to meditate for more than half an hour. Isn't it a shame? So you can actually tell them just how wonderful it was. And say, look, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Look at me. I meditated for much longer than half an hour. A wonderful time. Beautiful time. And if it wasn't any good, then sort of, you know, have a look at me. And if you actually go back and you're much worse than when you came here, that isn't any good, and you're a bad sort of advertisement for this. But a lot of you will be so peaceful, so nice, so soft, that people say, hey, what have you been doing? And they sort of, they say, can I come next year? Because I want to be like that. So you prove it, just not by the words, but by who you are. And that really impresses people. That it's best to meditate for as much as you can. Sometimes you have this idea in, I think, Christianity. I think most of the fundamentals of Christianity, if you empty your mind, so then the devil will come in. But you find out, doesn't it? If that's a devil, it's a beautiful devil that comes in. So wonderful, so blissful, so lovely. Oh, I'll have this devil any day. And it's not the devil, it's obviously, you know these things, you can feel them, you know it's pure, it's wonderful, it's blissful, it's lovely. So sometimes it's just fear. So it's, you know, get people to say these things. Some people say it's dangerous to meditate. And the other answer to that, if they ask you, is it dangerous to meditate? You say, it's more dangerous not to meditate. Is it hard to meditate? So it's much harder not meditating. It's true, isn't it? Ajahn, what does an intractable mind mean? Please explain the significance of relics. An intractable mind, there's no such thing as a mind which is intractable, it's only temporarily intractable. Mostly because you've made it so hard by all this controlling business. So if it's intractable, it's just like this really solid lump of a mind. You just want to soften it. Just like anything else, like soak it in beautiful loving kindness overnight. When you wake up in the morning, it's all soft and gooey. Let's say the insipid the Buddha uses is like clay. If there's not enough water in that clay, it's so hard you can't sort of mould it into anything. And that, you know, moisture is like happiness, joy. And so people have got hardly any joy, just go into meditation, just like a US Marine. Yeah. Then they become intractable, it doesn't work, they can't do anything with it. But if you give yourself heaps and heaps of happiness, then you can do anything with the mind. You'll go wherever you want. Say, go and get my previous memories of my previous life, mind. The mind just goes off and brings them for you. Just like, you know, teach me about non-self, and this mind just goes and does it for you. Can I get the dharana now, please? Okay, so the mind just goes and does it for you. When it's got lots of happiness like that, it does anything for you. That's what the tractable mind is. So intractable one is one with no happiness. So if you don't give yourself happiness in life, you find that the mind becomes a solid lump, intractable, just like a stone in everybody's way. And everybody who comes close to you just hits their feet on the stone, stumps themselves. And physics has played the significance of relics. Relics are really fascinating. Because sometimes these relics of great monks from the past or the Buddha, sometimes you take them into your temple and there's only two of them. And when you next look at them, there's three. Or there's four. That's what happened in the Buddhist Fellowship recently. And Mahamogalan's relics, another one came from nowhere. Many, many stories of that. So they're fascinating. For those of you who don't believe in psychic phenomena or magical phenomena, stuff like that, relics is just one of the most common strange phenomena you could, that people, Buddhists actually know of, because they see it happening so regularly. If you have some Buddha relics in your shrine, in your temple, even if in your house, although it's not really good to have them in your house, when you're a good person, you worship them, you do your precepts, maybe do a puja every now and again, or regularly is even better, and a very, very compassionate, kind person, you find those relics increasing in number. But if you misbehave and you don't do all these good things, you find those relics disappearing. In Melbourne, the president of the Buddhist Society of Victoria told me once that some monk came and offered him some relics. It was supposed to be for the temple. But he was one of these philosophical Buddhists. You know, actually, maybe no Pali, and read the sutras, but never practiced a word of them. Would actually go to the temple, keep the five precepts, and go home and have a tot of whiskey. And that became, this is actually sometimes that happens in Sri Lanka, and Sri Lankan people know that happens, it happens in Thailand as well. You know what I kept on saying in Malaysia, when you saw people when they're taking the five precepts, they take them with one or two fingers down, like this. They just have three fingers up. That meant that they were only keeping three precepts that day. They still chant them all, but they thought if you chant with your hands up properly, that means you're going to keep all five. So if you put one finger down, that meant you're only going to keep four. But you can still chant them all, because then, you know, sort of you were doing the ceremony. And some people were chanting like that. With all their fingers down. They're still doing the chanting, saying they're doing these things, but that was almost like crossing your fingers behind your back. That became like a fashion for a while. So anyway, everyone was joining the chanting. Looks like they were keeping the precepts, but they're putting the fingers down to see how many they would keep after all. And so that a person like that, he didn't really believe in his relic business. How can these these be actually relics of the Buddha. There's so many of these relics around. It's just superstition. He was like an intellectual Buddhist, not believing in all this rigmarole stuff. So he put it in the cupboard of his home and forgot about it. About a year later, he remembered, I was supposed to take it to the temple. Took them out, they're all gone. All vanished. You can't keep relics in the cupboard of your home. They just disappear. So there's all these things, if you look after them, they grow. If you don't look after them, they disappear. Go to someone who does look after them. So interesting, because actually they show you just amazing things which happen. Things which have got no scientific background. But which are true, you see, happen. Given that I'm not a monk or a nun, nor about to become one, the future is uncertain. Who knows? Given that I'm not a monk or a nun, and think I'm not about to become one, what tip can you give us, please, for when we go home to help us apply what we have learned, gained, and to be able to continue our practice while happily attending to our families, partners, work communities, and even the Buddhist Society of WA business, etc. Okay, that's tomorrow's talk. So what happens when you go home? Next question. Can you kindly explain the significance of the standing Buddha at Dhammaloka, the one with the hand touching the ground, and the one with two hands open, one hand facing up and the other to the side? Thank you. These are all that the so-called namuvas. These are just symbols of Buddhism. And so the one with the hand up like this is not trying to stop the traffic. Some people think it means that, so to say, the fearless. It's almost like showing an open hand, like a fearlessness. So a Abhaya mudra. And the one which is touching the ground, it comes from the story just before the Buddha was about to become enlightened, under Bodhi tree, when Mara came to try and tempt him and try to stop him becoming enlightened. That I think the first thing which Mara said was like, who do you think you are to sit in this, you know, holy spot? And then Buddha touched the ground and the earth quaked, as if he was saying that all the spirit, the beings, the earth beings, acknowledged that because of his past accumulated karma, he had the right to sit in this power spot where people become enlightened. So it's actually the earth bearing witness. And the other one with two hands open, one hand facing up and the other to the side. Which was that? Don't know that one. Usually got the samadhi posture with two hands in the lap there. And usually when, you know, a couple of hands which are like this, that's the teaching dhamma posture. So the ones we've got over behind me, what have you got there? Touching the earth, bear witness. This is fearless, and that's samadhi. Samadhi posture, those are the three we've got there. But that's only sort of tradition. It's just, sorry? Ong Lan. That's the one. Yeah, he's just got his hands up. Fearless posture. Yes. Now that actually comes afterwards. It's supposed to be the Abhaya mudra, the fearless. However, the people interpret them in all different ways. So I think that's an interpretation which came later. Yeah?
It's a very interesting book in the library. Okay.
Yes, yes. So it's in the library there. If you have a look at it and see if I've made a mistake. Okay, but also when people do statues, sometimes they invent new ones. So it's interesting. Yeah? You have to make your own power spot. The place you get enlightened becomes a power spot. On the way, it helps. So if you can get to an IA's power spot, then it really can help you. Okay, can you kind of explain this to people? Oh, I've got a hand touching the ground. Okay, that's the same one, just put it in the wrong place. Next question. Dear Ajahn Brahm, this is something I've always wanted to know. Can Deva become enlightened in the Deva realm? Thank you. It is unlikely, but it can happen. Even the time of the Buddha, some devas would come down and listen to a talk of the Buddha and become enlightened. So it is possible, but it's unlikely. Because a lot of time the devas are too busy enjoying themselves. They're having too good a time. They sort of get very attached to their sensory pleasures. So it's very hard for devas sometimes actually to remember the Dhamma and actually to practice the Dhamma. Usually they say it's very hard for devas to practice Dhamma. All they can do is listen to Dhamma. But sometimes that's enough if they've done lots of practice in the past. Probably the story which is, I think I already told you about Gopika and those two monks. One was both messing around for the whole range retreat, and Gopika was she the lady who supported them, looked after them, fed them, made sure everything was okay. And when the two monks died, they were born in just a really low realm. She was really upset. All these donations I've given to you. Well, imagine that sort of, you know, if you died and I got reborn in a lower realm than you. I listened to Dhamma from you all these years. I thought you were just much better than this, Ajahn Brahm. And I gave all these donations to you, and I, you know, fed you and looked after you all these years, and that's all you've been doing. Oh, you'd really turn me off, wouldn't you? And you deserve it. But anyway, this lady told these two monks off, and one of them listened, the other one just basically told her to go and get stuck. in other words, and what actually happened was the one who listened eventually left that realm and went to the pure abodes. I think he actually got an enlightened experience because of the scolding. So it was an example where you did get enlightened in those realms, thanks to the scolding of a very good woman. Many thanks for the teachings and guidance, for the stiff backaches, for the sore buttocks, for the creaky over bent knees, and nowhere near jhana. And he got after this, I quit. Just kidding. Ah, you shouldn't kid, you should really quit. Quit! Quit trying. Jhana meditation dropout, fifth timer. P.S. May enroll again next year. Some people are blunts of punishment. Quit now. Just quit trying, quit controlling. End it all. What beautiful people you all are. May each of you be very happy and very well. Thank you for the amazing energy and love. Let's remember this pressure retreat isn't over yet. Let's continue to keep noble silence. It's so hard to find out there. It's very nice, isn't it? Very well written. And it's also just a reminder that we've got another whole day of meditation. And if, actually I forgot, because actually today was Anzac Day, so when I said the paycheck's coming today, the post doesn't run on Anzac Day. So it must be coming tomorrow. Special delivery, Saturday. So tomorrow is payday. So, we've got another whole day. So don't throw away these magic moments. We've got this wonderful retreat this evening, tomorrow morning, and even just after lunch. So it's so easy in our life to throw away things. We think we're finished, but we haven't really finished yet. We think it's over when there's hours to go. We throw away so much of our life, rushing off the next thing. So the retreat doesn't end until the final blessing is given. And that's a long way from now. And who knows, the retreat might not even end then. You remember that story I like telling at the end of every retreat? The real story about this New Zealand monk called Hab Wong, who came to Wat Arachai in Thailand years ago and told us this story. He said he joined a monastery in Korea, one of these very tough Zen monasteries. It was actually very famous at the time. The teacher was just very, very renowned, very, very tough, but a great meditator and very wise. And every year they'd do a retreat, a monastery retreat. They didn't allow any lay people in there because it was just too tough. 60 days. Well, you get up sometime like 3 o'clock in the morning, and you'd meditate for 50 minutes, you'd walk for 10 minutes, meditate for 50 minutes, walk for 10 minutes, all in the same hall. And there would be no sort of toilet breaks, no sort of So going back to your room and having a snooze breaks the Torah, it was absolutely tough. In fact, you'd actually sleep the place where you sat. When it got to about 11 o'clock, you're allowed just to lay out in the same place in the hall where you're sitting meditation. So when the bell went in the morning for 3 o'clock, you were already there, you couldn't sort of snooze because the master was there and everyone was there. And just like, you know, a small meal a day. It was really tough. I don't know how many times you sat that day. You know, right throughout the day, 50 minutes, 10 minutes, 50 minutes, 10 minutes, again, 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 until about 11 o'clock. And he said that sometimes, when it got to 11 o'clock, some of those monks would actually carry on sitting afterwards. It was really disgusting, it really, they were very upsetting. Show-offs. And you can imagine, even after one day, his knees and back were just aching. Because he never meditated so long before, he was a Westerner. He wasn't born like these Asians, able to sort of sit on the floor all the time. He was used to seats and armchairs and sofas and things like that. So after that 3 or 4 days, you know, 9 days, sometimes even with all these chairs which you have and cushions, you know, you're aching. Imagine a retreat like that. It was just agony. And after 1 week, he thought he'd have to sort of run away. But what he did, he said, he sort of looked up and saw all these Korean monks sitting. And he was the only Westerner there, and thinking, I can't be outdone by these Asians. So he decided to carry on for another week. And it was so hard and difficult, sometimes he was almost crying in pain. And he had to keep on going. He gets to the point after a couple of weeks, you've gone through so much, actually to give up is like almost being unfaithful to all your effort. You say, you know, well, if I was going to give up, I should have given up when I started, but I've done 2 weeks of pain. Surely I can push through a little bit longer. And he kept on pushing that way. It wasn't any fun or no joy, it was just pain, 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 endurance, endurance, endurance. And whenever he'd get to the 11 o'clock bell at night and he'd be able to sort of stretch out, when the pain went and he could rest, the next thing he knew the bell was gone. And it was 3 o'clock, he had to start again. Just the sleep was no sort of escape, it just disappeared, just in unconsciousness, just like a flash. And it was all to do again, another day in front of him. And he said that it was only when he got to the halfway mark, you know, the 30 days, that he'd done that much, and he realised he had to do the last 30 days. It was over halfway. You know what it's like in a retreat sometimes? You think, 4 days, 5 days, okay, I've done most of it now. I'm over halfway. So he continued on. And it was so agony, the hardest thing he's ever done. And he got to only 2 weeks left, and he started to get exciting, and he just 1 week left. And yes, usually happens with that sort of mind. The closer it got to the end, the more painful it became. When it came to the last day, so that's the most painful day of his life. It just every hour, a 50-minute sit was like sort of, you know, a whole month. But, you know, the clock sort of, you know, hardly. Sometimes you'd open your eyes and have a look, see what's going on, and the clock went so slowly. He started to think the batteries must be dead. Perhaps actually the batteries are dead and that clock will stop forever at 10 minutes before the bell is supposed to go, and the head monk won't realise it. It was so painful. Then eventually they got to the final sitting. There's one more 50 minutes to go and the retreat will be over. And so he started thinking, just, you know, as you do, just what I'll do when I get home. He started thinking about the hot bath, just lying out and just in a hot bath, and all these aches and pains just disappearing, and having a really nice meal, not just in your bowl and just, you know, silent, a really nice meal, a nice talk with the fellow monks. But he could only keep that perception only for about 2 minutes because the pain broke in, and he had to fight the pain again, just do battle with it for the last 50 minutes. He said that was the biggest battle, the last 50 minutes. The pain, as always happens in the last sit, the last 5 minutes, it just gets worse and worse. And even though he got so far, many times he said he almost gave in and just got out, just ran away. It was that bad. But then finally, at long last, you can imagine what happens. The final bell sounded. And as soon as the final bell sounded at the end of the 50 minutes, the last sit was the last day of the 60-day retreat, the pain all disappeared. And just that bliss just rolled through his body. He'd done something very hard. He pushed his way through. He didn't feel the pain because the bliss was just too much. And they went to bow, and then the bell went again. And the abbot, the head monk, the master, said, "Before you get up, I've got an announcement to make. During the interview times, I've found out for many of you that you found this retreat so wonderful, the best retreat we've had in this monastery. You've got so much out of this retreat. You've got so much progress that some of you have asked whether we can extend it for another month. I think this is a very good idea. Carry on sitting." You can imagine so what this monk felt. He had to cross his legs again. He couldn't go down to his bath or his meal. He had to cross his legs again and start to another month of all of this. But he said, in all honesty, he never felt any pain. He just felt raw anger. And he was trying to work out who these two bloody monks were and what he was going to do to them. He forgot all his precepts. It's actually murderous, he said. He was going to pull them apart limb by limb. And in the middle of his hatred, the bell went again. And about 20 minutes had passed in a flash. And the master said, "Retreat over, there's refreshments down there, nice hot baths for you. Off you go." It's a true story, it's not made up. And this monk, he didn't know what was going on. So what's going on? So are we having a retreat? Oh, we're not having a retreat. What's happening? And one of the other monks, who was a bit older, came up to him, saw his confusion, and he could speak English. And this other Korean monk said, "Look, don't worry, the master does the same trick every year." It was a put on. And he said he learned more in that last 20 minutes than he'd ever learned in the whole retreat. Expectation. That's what caused all the pain and the anger and the ill will. And from that time on, he never anticipated the end of a retreat. Who knows whether it's going to go on even longer. Actually, some of you have said, "How wonderful this retreat is. Can we keep it going for another couple of weeks?" Unfortunately, we can't. So that's actually one of those two stories of what anticipation is. You don't know what's going to happen next. And once you do start to second guess the future, that's when you're asking for trouble. Once you make all these plans about what's going to happen next, and you've got no movement, no ability to adapt and throw away your plans for changing circumstances, that's when you get so rigid and forceful. That's where all the stress, the pain, disappointment, and raw anger come from. Frustration. When the future is so uncertain, you only make tentative plans at best. No more than that. And that way you're free. Last question. On behalf of Buddhist Fellowship members, I would like to thank BSWA members for their generosity and kindness. Also big thanks to Ajahn Brahm and his super mindful monks. That's some energy. Very good. It's nice to have praise. They say praise factory gets you everywhere. So, thanks for coming this evening. The night is still young. People out there in the world are just beginning to party. Now it's the time for us to party. This is Java party time. So, if you could do this one. Okay, yeah, that's the tour. So, now it's enlightenment or bus time. The last evening of the retreat. So remember, you can sleep any time. But also remember how Ananda became enlightened. Yeah, this is about to go to sleep. So if it doesn't work on a sitting cushion, try that. But be kind to yourself. Remember, just go to the present moment. If you think it's a good time to meditate, just meditate. Don't even think about the retreat ending. Or not ending. Just meditate this evening as you would meditate on the third or fourth day of the retreat. Don't allow the passing of time to interrupt the enjoyment of the present moment. There is no time. There is no beginning of a retreat, no end of a retreat. This is all just our perceptions and ideas. So let it all go, just be in the present moment. When you get tired, go to bed. When you wake up, get up and sit. do that all your life. It's the first day of the retreat, the last day of the retreat, all the same. Just being in the present moment. If you want to know why, because there's nothing. There is no tomorrow, there is no yesterday, it's only now. So off you go, enjoy the now.